Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is the second installment of our Noble Experiment, a second weekly, shorter dig analyzing the past week's news. It's what some might call a diglet.
Because I said everything. I hit him with neo-Nazi. I hit him with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi, I got them all in there, let's see. But yeah, KKK, we have KKK.
My guest today is Alex Perrine, politics editor at Splinter. We're going to discuss his recent piece there, entitled Charlottesville Was a Preview of the Future of the Republican Party, along with other things about the Republican Party and its leader, Donald Trump. Before we get started, I want to thank the dozens of people who signed up to support us on Patreon.com after last week's show. Doing this second weekly episode costs time and money, and we can really only afford to keep it up if you, our loyal listeners, contribute. So please, if you haven't already, go to Patreon.com, that's Patreon.com, and make a contribution. A dollar a month is great, $5 is even better, and we will mail you book swag if you throw down $10 or more. Again, this second weekly episode isn't a for sure permanent thing yet, so if you like it and want us to keep it going, please hit pause for a moment and go to patreon.com to support the show. Our estimate is that less than 3% of our roughly 15,000 weekly listeners are currently donating. We are really grateful for all the support that we have received, but we do think we can do a little bit better. Okay, here's the show. Alex Perrine, welcome to The Dig.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So on Wednesday night, Trump went to his happy place, Phoenix, Arizona, and was met with large protests. He suggested he would pardon anti-immigrant Sheriff Joe Arpaio, celebrated Confederate statues as our heritage, defended his response to Charlottesville, called out Antifa by name, threatened to shut down the government if Congress doesn't fund his border wall, and took shots at Senators McCain and Flake. What was he up to, if you can go so far to ascribe agency, intentional kind of thinking, planning to him?
Well, as you described, that it's his happy place. The tell with him is that everything always goes back to the 2016 election, and whether that's giving out copies of his electoral map victory to people or trying to go home again to when he was happy, which is when he just kept defying all the experts and winning in 2016. And just speaking before an arena full of his supporters just going completely off script is like when he is at his happiest, and when that's when he forgets about how much he actually hates everything about the job of being president.
So it's not part of any grand strategy looking ahead to 2018 or 2020. He does it for the feels.
I hesitate to ascribe strategy to him. I mean, he's canny, but he's not really strategic. So I think that he thinks, and he probably has people around him who tell him that the way to get his numbers back up is to go back out on the trail and meet the voters. So he might, trying to launch his reelection campaign a few months into, less than a year into his presidency, might be what he thinks is strategically a good move. But his minders, even if they claim that they're horrified at what he might say, they're probably just happy to have him out of the house, basically. Like they are like, he'll blow off some steam and he'll be in a better mood if he just goes out and goes through one of his rallies again, and then he'll be a happier person and we can manage him a little bit more easily.
So it's like the President Trump version of an infant's nap time.
Yeah, it totally is. Yeah, and that's exactly my
my baby was just refusing to eat his cereal and was shouting at the cat. And I knew it was time for him to just lay down for a little bit. And that's what President Trump had to do yesterday.
So he defended his response to Charlottesville last night, which he failed to mention included blaming both sides, and talked about how he went out of his way to denounce the KKK and white supremacists, and the media didn't give him any credit. And it was really Trump doing the Trump thing. And this is just, you know, not so long after he gave this sober, scripted, you know, America needs to come together to fight this war in Afghanistan speech. What do you make of what has become this very typical dynamic of Trump letting Trump do his thing and then seemingly under heavy, heavy pressure from advisor giving these scripted, quote unquote, you know, presidential speeches and then back again?
It goes back to the campaign, but you could see he, because of his very, very simplistic sense of like dominance politics, to use a popular buzz phrase, he sort of grasps that he looks weak if he gives in to any pressure to do anything that he is sort of on the record saying he doesn't want to do. And so over and over again, it's like the David Duke endorsement that he refused to renounce and then was pressured into doing it. Like, he, every time he's pressured into doing something like that, he comes back harder immediately afterwards because he resents the fact that someone made him do that. He thinks his instincts are always right. And when the funny thing is, like, his instincts were totally right to win this really improbable and narrow presidential victory that was possible only because of our fucked up electoral system. So he's like, he now thinks his instincts are right for everything.
His instincts did turn out to be a lot better than a lot of the people who, including me, in some sense, who thought he wouldn't win.
Yeah, I mean, he showed that this two-step dance of doing a fucked up thing and then being forced to give a sort of disingenuous walk back. He showed how sort of pointless that is to dance to the tune of sort of sober pundit saying, oh, well, he must walk back that outrageous thing he did. You know, Trump, it's funny, he still gets the pressure to do that. And he clearly still has people in the White House pressuring him to do that when he goes as far as he did after Charlottesville. But he has intuited that he should just never apologize and always double down. And then it'll take this weird form now where, you know, he will just reinvent what the original offense was, or just slightly rejigger what the original offense was so that he can say, oh, you know, I never should have walked it back because what I originally said was fine. But I don't know. It's all pretty transparent, but it has the side effect of revealing how pointless the game of renouncing is in like political media.
So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, Trump was in sort of serious presidential mode on Monday night when he announced a major troop surge into the forever failed war in Afghanistan. Do you think he's just wagging the dog, attempting to deflect attention away from everything going on at home? Or he did, after all, make a point of saying that Americans weren't really allowed to disagree with each other because it offends the troops. Or do you think it was more Trump capitulating to his beloved generals? Or is it just Trump actually being kind of a normal American president who, since September 11th, just sends U.S. troops and ordnance all over the world to no foreseeable end?
It's a lot of those things, really. It's a big mishmash of those things. I think the policy itself, which is still sort of a mystery to me, is him listening to his generals because he, you know, surrounded himself with like lackeys, Bannon types, and then a bunch of generals, and the generals are sort of the last ones standing. And he has a cartoonish, like, respect for what the generals say. And so,
and for their masculinity, I think.
Yeah, exactly. For their, exactly. For the, you know, their shiny, their shiny medals and their uniforms.
And firm testicles.
Yeah. So even if he, I think, instinctually was like, this fucking Afghanistan thing is a, you know, a nightmare and we should cut and run. I think instinctually he sort of thought that. The generals like convinced him, and he didn't really have anyone around to convince him otherwise. But the speech was him, you know, trying to get to enjoy the trappings of the presidency, which is you get to deliver sober White House speeches about how you're doing war, and then the country used to come together to do war and support war. So it's all like, I think he gets less pleasure out of that aspect of the presidency than he does out of the campaign rally part of it. But his minder's hope that what happens when he gives a speech like that is it resets everyone, especially the dumber TV pundits who you can see a few of them attempting to be like, well, this is the greatest speech of his presidency. And even if they'd be like, you know, we're not like, it's a low bar, it works every damn time. When he goes out and like the horse that could do arithmetic, like when he shows he can read without without accidentally tripping down the stairs, people are like, oh, you know, that was actually gotta give him credit for that. So, you know, again, he is in such a manic mode right now that he like stepped on his own dick immediately afterwards and went to Phoenix to do a campaign rally. But if he could have stuck to like, I'm the sober war president for like a week, it really like actually might have gotten some people to think, well, this is the new Trump. So I don't know. He's his own worst enemy in it when it comes to whatever the strategy is of getting the sober pundits on board.
Yeah, you wrote really presciently about this quite a few months back. I believe it was after the address that he gave. Was it his State of the Union address?
Yeah, it was the fake State of the Union. Yeah.
Yeah, the joint address or whatever the fake so too was.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean the rapturous reviews came again when he talked about military action. When he talked about authorizing strikes in distant lands. With no coherent...
after a totally bungled raid in Yemen the first time, I believe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the bungled raid, which he refused to sort of accept responsibility for, blamed on everyone else. It should have been a debacle. It should have been like the press should have treated it as a debacle. But because he talked about the troops and again, didn't accidentally say a racial slur. They were like, this is the greatest moment of his presidency already. But he operates on a really basic feedback loop, which is he sees what gets him good clippings and he does more of it. It's been clear for a very long time that the way to get good press is to, to talk about the sober need for all Americans to support strategically incoherent, endless war far away.
And it happened again after, obviously, when he struck the Syrian military, which led to the infamous invocation of Leonard Cohen by Brian Williams.
Yeah, Jesus, yeah. I don't know. I'm appalled. I'm appalled anew every time, because it's like this sort of professional agreement that, you know, we can't criticize the military because it's the greatest institution in American society, and like whatever, like the military aside, there's never been any evidence that there is any like end to any of these wars. There's no strategy, and like you can't just say that. You know, or you you I
It's verboten from the mainstream political discourse. Everyone's on the, this is as much of a freak show as Trump is. This is, frankly, him at his most normal, which is that you go and get the troops killed and you still look like you support the troops as long as you give a shout out to the troops that you just got killed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Of course, this would be the one part of the presidency Trump would be good at. And it, like, he has always known how to, I mean, he's like a military school baby boomer guy. So it's like he knows how to act like he respects the troop while also like having gotten deferments from fighting in Vietnam. The prohibition against criticizing the military then has like for years extended to a prohibition against criticizing any military action whatsoever. And then it leads to the weird hypocrisy of like constantly getting American service members killed for no coherent reason is not considered disrespecting the troops for some reason.
But a few years ago, there was this big blow up when Chris Hayes, in a remarkably honest moment on national TV, sort of mused about the cult of the soldier in the U.S. That was too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking of Trump, the war president, this ties into recent palace intrigue. Bannon, of course, was booted out of the White House. What do you make of the move? As odious as the guy is, he was also one of the few potential checks on the very mainstream militarism embraced by his so-called globalist enemies in the White House. And his departure certainly doesn't seem to have made Trump any less racist.
Yeah, I think it was, Bannon was useful to Trump, but Trump again intuited what kind of man he would need to be to win the Republican nomination all on his own. You know, there was no Bannon around when Trump went full on birther. So people overestimated Bannon's influence a bit, and he certainly did nothing to dissuade people from doing that. But you know, the only interesting thing about him is his conception of what a popular ethno-nationalist populist presidency would look like. And it would be, these big infrastructure plans and welfare chauvinism combined with a form of isolationism. But even that was always overstated because it was more like, you know, he wanted trade war with China and and his plan for the Middle East was basically let the mercenaries handle it. Which is like he wanted to make it sort of like,
which is also old school.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted to make it more brutal for them, but less of an investment for the United States, but like more brutal for the countries that our mercenaries are, occupying. I think people like to say, oh, you know, he would have pushed Trump to be less militaristic, but the only place where he actually probably was a voice of reason was North Korea, weirdly enough. If you want to listen, if you want to read that insane interview he did
with
the prospect, he was like talking like reasonable sense on how there are no good military options against North Korea
that don't involve like Seoul being totally
don't
eliminated,
yeah, Seoul being obliterated and within minutes. And that was just him being realist. And what's funny is that like that form of realism has like no place in mainstream United States militarism and foreign policy, where it's like the mainstream argument is you have to be as belligerent as possible because otherwise your enemies won't respect you. So I don't know. The Bannon ouster was Trump getting, again, sort of caving to pressure, but also getting annoyed that Bannon kept doing things like giving bizarre on the record interviews to the prospect. And obviously with a lot of it was just about Bannon like increasingly openly being at war with Trump's daughter and son-in-law, and they're going to win every internal argument in this White House that is about like personnel, even though they keep losing every argument that is about policy if you listen to sources close to them.
So looking back from Trump's inauguration to today, there's basically a whole new cast of high-level White House staff and advisors. Does it matter?
I think it matters. It probably matters less than the people he picked early on to be in his cabinet. And it matters less than the people that the Heritage Foundation picked for him to staff the agencies. Like, those were the important moves. The fact that basically he's surrounded at this point by very few conventional Republicans and a lot of just kind of random Trump world loyalists and these generals, I think it means that his relationship with Congress is only going to get worse, and it was only going to get worse anyway as long as they continue to do anything involving Russia sanctions and the Russia investigation. So it probably means that they feel more free to follow Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's agenda and ignore whatever Trump would like them to do. And he's going to be sort of impotent watching that because he's shitty at politics, which is like a thing everyone could have seen coming when they sort of feared what he would do, including Republicans. Is like, Trump doesn't really know how to do politics. Like, he knows how to do electoral politics. He doesn't have any clue how to do Washington politics. So we're just going to see him lashing out a lot, and we're going to see Jeff Sessions. It's going to be Jeff Sessions running the administration however he wants to do it on his corner of it. And it's going to be these generals presenting war plans for him to sign off on while he runs around the country winking at white nationalists. Like, that's, and I feel like that's going to be the presidency for the foreseeable future.
In short, still plenty fucking terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of damage he can do, even as a sort of politically impotent president.
I want to talk about a recent piece you wrote. You wrote that the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville was a, quote, introduction to the future leadership of the Republican Party. And you weren't making the obvious case that the Republican Party is and has long been racist. Rather, you were saying that young people are fleeing the Republican Party in huge numbers, and that the few who are still inclined to join its leadership are more likely than ever to be unabashed racists. Explain your argument.
Yeah, if you look at any polling data, you can see that the Republicans have been doing really shitty with everyone under 30 for a long time now. They tend to think that, these guys will just get more conservative as they get older. But the polling is not bearing that out. Generation X is sort of would be the test case for that, because they all already are getting older. And they've gotten more liberal and not less, basically, since 9/11. So what that means is you have this small core of young people who are committed Republicans. I think if you look at the last couple of presidential cycles, it's a third of people under 30 are inclined to vote Republican, but it's maybe a quarter of them who are like serious Republicans who aren't in danger of leaving the party completely. But what that means is that the ones who are left are like really, really into it. And even more worryingly, like, the ones who aren't just like committed to voting Republicans, but the ones who want to get active in Republican politics, the ones who want to be college Republicans, the ones who want to do the sort of political work that would lead to you being a party leader someday. You have to ask yourself, what would motivate someone to want to be more active in Republican politics in this era, since Trump basically seized the party? The motivations are not, I respect the cerebral conservatism of William F. Buckley. These are not a bunch of people who read David Brooks and then decide they want to bring humility back to politics.
Yeah, they're not they're not inviting people from the National Review masthead even to speak on their campus. They're inviting Milo and Ann Coulter.
Yeah, exactly. So what the impetus for the thing I wrote was that you had a couple people at in Charlottesville, which was an avowed white nationalist rally. You know, they were it was the point at which the alt-right lost their ironic deniability. They used to be able to say, well, we're just being ironic online. But when you're marching in the streets with actual neo-Nazis, you lose that ironic deniability. So it was a coming out party for the alt-right as an avowed white nationalist movement. And then you had a couple people there who were identified as college Republicans, leaders. One of them was the president of his college Republicans chapter. These are the sort of people who want to be involved in the college Republicans at this point. And Republicans have a pipeline to that creates candidates, basically. And the feeder for this pipeline starts with organizations like the college Republicans. So a few years down the line, what's going to happen is they're going to have hardly anyone in this pipeline, because hardly anyone was active in Republican politics in this era. The people who are in it, even if they weren't in Charlottesville themselves, are going to be people who actively sympathized with what Charlottesville was all about. Because those are, you know, those are the people in college Republican organizations, not just running them, but sort of driving away anyone who doesn't agree with them. Because why would you join that organization if you were just a regular conservative person and not someone who sympathized with white nationalists? Why would you join the college Republicans when they are being led by people who constantly invite Milo to speak at campuses? And so what was telling me was that even at Columbia, where you would think, again, like Columbia would be the place where the college Republicans are just like lacrosse bros who don't want to make sure. Yeah, they don't want to be taxed. They want to protect their inheritances. Like even they keep inviting people like Mike Cernovich, who is an alt-right leader, and Tommy Robinson, who is the founder of the English Defense League, which is like a gang of street hooligans in the UK that hates Muslims. Like they've extended speaking invites to these people. This is the Columbia College Republican. So yeah, I think the allegiances and affiliations of the current crop of young Republican leaders is really obvious. And again, a couple years down the line, this is not to say all Republicans are white nationalists, even if there are sort of racial resentments driving conservatism for years. But your only options for, you know, the future candidates are going to be people who agree with Mike Cernovich and Milo, people who spent this era of our history promoting people like Milo, are going to be state legislators, because a bunch of voters who just check the box for the Republicans are going to be electing them to office. We're going to have this whole crop of leadership of Republicans in a few years who are right now effectively white nationalists. And it's going to be happening even as the country grows more liberal. And it's going to happen even if the country loudly turns against Trumpism, which I think could easily happen in the next few years. But because of our electoral system, because of the fact that the two parties have a stranglehold on ballot access, and because of the fact that one of the two parties basically, when you average it out, wins 50% of the time, Republicans are going to be stuck with these people as their leaders for years.
Oh, well, God bless America. Alex Perrine, thank you so much.
Yeah, on that cheerful note.
Yeah, wow. I was going to ask, like, where does the revolution happen question, but we're out of time.
Well, we'll get to that next time. Wait, let me plug my podcast.
Oh, yeah, please do. Please do.
I do a podcast with Matt Taibbi called The Tarfu Report. You can find it. We're on Patreon. We can find it on the internet. So check it out.
And the most recent episode is with Keith Ellison, I believe.
Yeah, we talked to Keith Ellison. It was a very great conversation.
Yeah, definitely check it out. And check out the article we were discussing on Splinter. The URL for that is what?
Splinternews.com.
Great. Alex, thanks very much. Alex Perrine is politics editor at Splinter. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once kind of said, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our Postmaster General is Christian Tyler. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And if it's on iTunes, please leave us a review. Those reviews really do help introduce us to new listeners. And so does telling your friends, so do that as well. Also, find us on Patreon, that's patreon.com, and make a monthly contribution. We really need the support. And thank you to those who are already supporting us.